This podcast was recorded Thursday, May 2nd at 10:32 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Like President Trump will stop publicly criticizing the judge and witnesses in his hush money trial and avoid contempt of court fines. We'll see. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who like to pick their voters before voters can pick or reject them. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up on the podcast, a police agency gets our Snollygoster of the Week award. But first, we all know Ohio's congressional and state legislative districts are gerrymandered to the extreme. Republican leaders at the State House have drawn them in such a way to give their party's candidates an advantage in as many districts as possible, even though polling and general election results show Ohio is at most 54% to 46% Republican. Republicans hold 60 to 70% of the seats in the State House and the State Senate. Those are the high-level numbers we've talked about on this podcast for years. But a new study from the progressive Brennan Center for Justice Public Policy Institute digs deeper and shows how gerrymandering has really taken away a true choice for a lot of Ohio voters. Joining us to discuss his research is the author of the study, Brennan Center Senior Counsel Yuri Rudensky. Yuri, welcome to Snollygoster.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
As we said, Ohio has had these gerrymandered, the latest version of gerrymandered districts since the 2011 cycle. That has resulted in very safe seats for a lot of Republicans and a fewer number of Democrats in Congress and in the state legislature. But you looked at the impact, and the number that jumps out is 9 million voters, 77% of the population. They practically have no real say in what party represents them in the state legislature. That's a big number, Yuri.
It was shocking. The results of when we opened up the hood and really looked at how things were working in practice, it was a shockingly high number. And as you dig deeper, it gets worse, quite frankly.
So we looked at just the state legislative districts, not the congressional districts for this study. How is it that these folks really don't have a say?
Well, so there's a couple of different ways where voters have very actual little impact over the actual results. One is you get uncontested districts where quite literally in November, voters will see only one of the major party candidates. That means there will just be one candidate, either from the Republican or Democratic Party, on the ballot for state house. And there are 15 districts in Ohio, where that's exactly what voters will see come November. Then there are other sorts of districts where there might be two names on the ballot, but because of the lopsided nature that the district is safely and durably Republican or Democratic, the competition isn't really there. And even if there are exceptional circumstances, the expectation is we know what the outcome will be, that it's all but been decided. Yeah. And so what that means is in all of these districts, the action isn't at the general election, it's in the primary. And so we thought, okay, well, that's legit. Primary competition matters as well. But when you dig into what's happening at the primary level, a shockingly low number of districts feature primary competition as well. So what we found, and what I think is really the most concerning number, is that in half, virtually half of the state house seats, the representative could essentially be known at the point that candidate filing ended. Back in December.
Yeah. Now that's not unheard of in politics, even in the most fair mapping process. That if you have a candidate, well, we have term limits here in Ohio, which means there's more turnover. But I look at other states that don't have the term limits, and a state rep who's been in office for a long time, whether they're Democrat or Republican, you know, they're powerful. They've done a good job taking care of their constituents. They're not going to face any competition until they retire, basically, or they get caught up in a scandal if that were to happen. How is this different?
Well, I think the important thing to remember in Ohio is the process was rotten. I mean, the folks that drew the lines, the politicians who held the pen, said that they were going to do this. And when there was litigation over the maps, and the Ohio Supreme Court repeatedly struck them down for violating the state constitution, saying that these maps deny Ohio voters fair representation. These are the byproduct of that rotten process. And so I think the premise of the question is, you know, can't this be the case even in a state where representation isn't skewed? And the answer is it could. And there could be a lot of contributing factors. But in Ohio, we knew this was the goal. And sure enough, the goal is being realized.
You list in one of your appendices in your piece, and we'll put a link to this, your study in the show notes for this podcast. But you have several districts, and they're not all the you talk about the folks who are basically have won re-election by filing. And there are Democratic districts in there, too. It's not just all Republican districts.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, with gerrymandering, everyone loses. Well, really, it's the voters who lose, you know, and there are politicians. So even if in this case, you have a Republican gerrymander, and you absolutely do, that locks in a durable supermajority. That was the purpose for the map that was drawn. But the reality was, at the end of the day, there was a handshake deal with the Democrats, because the Democrats, they also get ultra safe districts where there's no competition. And so when you think about who is left holding the bag, it's the people, it's the voters. It's the fact that you have districts that don't make any sense, that combine communities in ways where you can't have a local grassroots campaign that is really trying to rise above the sort of national politics, the wedge issues, and really speak to the concerns of real people on the ground in their local community, which I feel like can actually bring people together across partisan divides. When people run on real solutions and you have an actual debate of ideas, that's really the vision of what our government should be and how it should function. And the problem with gerrymandering is it pulls the rug out from that very basic and fundamental premise of democracy.
Yeah, you mentioned how, like, the House Minority Leader, State Rep. Allison Russo from suburban Columbus, she is in one of those districts where it's uncontested from the primary on, a Democrat. She signed off on the maps, on the latest maps. Now, there's a vote coming up. We'll talk about that in a minute. But as of right now, this map stays in place until the to the 2030 census. So now here's what the supporters of these maps say. They say, of course, they claim they're not gerrymandered, and the Supreme Court has disagreed with them, as you mentioned. But ultimately, it is up to the voters. They argue candidates can run, and if they run hard enough, raise enough money, they can win, even in a district where they're not favored. In your research, how often does that happen?
Exceptionally rarely. Exceptionally rarely. And look, I mean, the reality, it's remarkable if you look back. Ohio is not the purple swing state that it once was. But when you look back over the prior decade, for example, from election to election, there are swings in terms of what number of voters turn out and want to support Republican candidates, and what number of voters turn out and want to support Democratic candidates. There is an ebb and flow. There's always an ebb and flow in politics, and there should be one in a democracy. And the reality is, when you look at, do districts change hands corresponding with these ebbs and flows in support? And the answer is not really. not in any sort of meaningful way.
Yeah, that's, we talked to one strategist, and he said that these maps were designed to, yes, give it a party an advantage, but also to survive a wave election.
Exactly.
You know, and where one party at the top of the ticket, say, is going to sweep, these maps are designed to protect the lower, the down ticket candidates who might get swept up in that wave.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what they are calibrated to do. And the reality is, in today's day and age, with the technology and the data that's available, you can do that. Mm-hmm. And you can do that. You can model all sorts of different electoral environments and draw districts in ways that are designed to, to put up a seawall against any kind of wave. And that's, that's the problem. And that's what happens when redistricting isn't oriented around, say, public interest, community interests, thinking about, where are relevant communities of interest, people who share certain interests, whether it's a commuting corridor, whether it's the presence of a particular type of industry, and making sure that districts are drawn so those folks can band together and have their needs addressed in the state house,
yeah,
in Congress. And instead, a process that is focused on, well, what is the partisan identity of voters, and when do certain voters turn out versus other voters turn out, and modeling this. And really, it's pretty crude, because it reduces people with full lives, with real needs, to just their partisan affiliation.
Can you go too far with trying to make elections competitive? I mean, if you are a Democrat in a rural district that is very conservative, you're out of luck. If you're a Republican in an urban district that is very progressive, you're out of luck. And can you in fact gerrymander the other way to make such districts competitive, when most of the people who live in those districts are like-minded, either progressive or conservative? Can you go too far the other way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there is such a thing as artificially advancing principles of competition. But the reality is, again, competition doesn't just occur in the general election. There can be an exchange of ideas in a primary. Mm-hmm. And there can also just be a more organic kind of politics where people are speaking to local issues. And I think something that has happened in recent years is everything has been nationalized.
Yeah.
And that is in part a function of districts that aren't drawn to band together people who have much in common whatsoever.
Yeah, example of that here in Ohio is, you look at polls and they say, especially among Republicans, immigration is like the number one or maybe number two issue. And immigration is important to every state, but it's not the number one issue like it would be in Texas or California or Arizona. We're on a border state. But that shows you, that's a perfect example of how our politics here have been nationalized because of, Donald Trump's stress on immigration and Republicans nationally stressing immigration.
Well, and another thing you can look at is, you can set party labels aside. The legislature just hasn't been legislating along the lines of what the public wants.
Well, actually, in Ohio, the legislature has not been legislating. They've had their least productive session so far, because what's happened here is they have the supermajority. They really don't have to worry about the Democrats. They're fighting amongst themselves, and the House Speaker has actually enlisted the help of Democrats to win the Speaker's position, and that has angered conservative Republicans. And it's a bit of a mess at the State House right now. It's almost like they don't know what to do with the power they have achieved.
And that's really what happens, though, is it leads to a broken politics where the legislature, by virtue of having that safety, that insulation from voters, irrespective of the sort of party dynamic, don't have to worry about delivering results.
Yeah, the fight is on the primary level.
Solutions that are consistent with what Ohioans want, and that is the problem.
One of the things I've often thought, you know, like we said, it dates back to 2011, and Democrats have just gotten really. There was a fairly close election when Mike DeWine was first elected governor. He defeated the Democrat Richard Cordray. I think it was within 5 points or so. But there, everyone complains that there's no Democrats in the pipeline. Democrats complain there's no people, no candidates coming up. And I think it goes back to gerrymandering, because if you are an aspiring state rep and you're a Democrat and the map is drawn to favor Republican, you're not going to run. You're not even going to bother to get your butt kicked in a general election. So you don't get, even if you lose and coming close, you've gained some political capital for a future run. Is that part of the reason why one party is down here in this state? Because of this map really stacks the odds against them, and they'll say, you know what, I'm going to go for city council instead. I'm going to go for county auditor or mayor even.
Well, I just think more generally it leads when the whole system is as rotten as it has been. I just think a lot of good folks see that and say that they just don't want to have any part of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure the dynamics that you speak of are a contributing factor, but another one is when you look at the sort of dysfunction, when you look at the corruption, when you look at what is even possible just from a policymaking standpoint, not even just a political viability standpoint. It's hard to look at the legislature and say, I care about my community and I want to be part of that. So I really do think the ripple effects from when something like gerrymandering becomes deep rooted in a state, the whole concept of representative democracy starts to atrophy and crumble. And I think when that happens, that also has huge consequences in terms of how people engage with their government.
I'm doing the math right here. Bear with me. Gerrymandering has been around for 212 years. It started in 1812, thanks to, it's credited with starting in 1812. It may have been going on before then, but Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry drew districts in Massachusetts to favor his party. But I think voters are catching on. We're seeing it in other states. It was always always thought to be too deep in the weeds, hard to explain. Do you think that gerrymandering's days are numbered? Because we have a vote coming up likely in November on our system. Other states have done it. Michigan did it. New York has changed its map making where it was gerrymandered on to favor Democrats. Do you think gerrymandering is on its way out?
I think if it were up to the people, if it were up to voters, it absolutely would be. It is an issue that even in these polarized times has a tremendous amount of support across the political spectrum. Americans deeply believe in a government of the people and by the people. And gerrymandering undermines those basic principles. And there's been a remarkable awakening in terms of people starting to take an interest in these systems of democracy, seeing how they're not functioning as they ought to. And so it is a very, very encouraging moment. There is real momentum here. There is a debate happening around making sure that representative democracy lives up to its promise. And that really puts a lot of wind in my sails. I find that incredibly encouraging. But the reality is that the entrenched interests, the politicians, the lobbyists, the people that wield power and that control, you know, tax dollars, and get to, do whatever they want. People don't give that ability up very easily. So, yeah. So, you know, it's going to be a fight. In Ohio, it's going to be a fight, but I do think voters are completely fed up with the status quo.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've you know, you're the same way. I've followed this for decades, and that people really know what's going on here now. Maybe it's because of the extreme gerrymandering aided by computer programs and algorithms and probably even AI at this point, that people realize that, you know, this ain't working, and maybe something needs to be done. A remarkable awakening is probably underway, and we will, in future episodes of this podcast, get into the details of the proposal that Ohio voters may face in November, likely will face in November, but today just the numbers alone are kind of startling. Thanks to Yuri Rudensky from the Brennan Center. Appreciate your appearance on Snollygoster.
Thanks so much.
Take care. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or the shrewdest political move of the past 7 days. This week, it's the latter. We give it to the Columbus Division of Police, who declined to get involved in last week's campus protest at Ohio State University. That protest led to 36 arrests and some complaints about police practices from those protesters. But the police who were on campus and made those arrests were Ohio State University police and Ohio State troopers. Columbus police were not there, so they were not in any video arresting students. CPD says, in this situation, this is their direct quote, in this situation, the division did not have the available resources requested or the ability to interact with the community the way it was requested, unquote. OSU says it did not request Columbus police support, but Columbus police say, yeah, they did. It looks like OSU was prepared to arrest students, and the Columbus police division was not ready to do that. After all the heat Columbus police took for their response to the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, they were shrewdly cautious this time, and for that, they get our Snollygoster of the Week award. And we should say that the protests, all things considered, were far less confrontational and far less violent, if you want to use that term, than what we saw at Columbia and what we saw at UCLA. So glad to see that OSU's campus was fairly quiet. That'll do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, try to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and just tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.